Why don't we just sort of take it from the top? I mean, just the idea of this is oral history, so I'd like you to do most of the talking and me to do most of the listening, and just, you know, tell me about your experiences with the Friends of Richard LaPointe.
Yeah. Well, it all began with a late night phone call from Bob Persky. And at the time, let's see, 1982, I was we were working in our own little nonprofit business, Pat Beeman and I, and we had been in touch with Bob off and on. So he called one night, very, very intense, as I think is a polite word, saying, basically, get your ass down to court. Something is happening that is a tragedy. It's an absolute tragedy. Mm-hmm. And at that time, we had not really heard about it. I mean, we weren't following the news and about Richard LaPointe. He said, there's something going on here that we all cannot let happen, and you have to be here. So, obedient as we are, we went to court the next day, actually. And that's when we first got a glimpse of the tragedy that Bob had indicated was occurring. We entered this court, and this was new to us. We had never really been into the court situation. None of our interactions with people had ever brought us into that particular context. So we went into the court, and as we had first entered, the entire right side of the courtroom was filled with people, and very quickly we learned that was the prosecutor side, the family side, and the left side was literally empty, and only in the front was Bob Persky. And alone, I think, at that point, because even the lawyer, I mean, the court had not begun for the day.
Mm-hmm.
And we entered that scene, and Bob came up, you know, and blah, 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 greeted us and gave us a little bit of preliminaries and just basically said, be here and listen, you know, and think. And so that began, and I can't tell you exactly when that was, but I think it was about maybe a month and a half before the verdict came down.
Mm-hmm.
And I've lost track of when the verdict was. But it was during the summer of 1992. That much I do know. So we began to come as often as we could. It was almost daily. And then others began to come. Actually, others came that same day, but we happened to be there a bit early. Folks from the ARC, and a few other folks that Bob had, you know, talked to and said we had to be there. And we began to kind of get a sense of what had happened and what was happening. We had never met Rich LaPointe, so we saw him come in, you know, to be with the lawyers and such, or however that works, and be in the front. You didn't know who we are, but we could begin to get a sense of the disproportion of what was occurring here. And we sat and listened to testimony and to watch the judge and watched the people interviewing the prosecutors, basically. And we began to see, maybe it was the second or third time we were there, that we sort of commented to one another that the jury was done. I mean, they were done already. I mean, it was, I don't know where it was, I don't know exactly when the trial had started, but they had been pretty much along the line. And as we had learned later, all the preliminaries to try to get the confessions out of the picture failed. And so we were dealing with the confessions, and we were dealing with you know, the power of the town police officers and the prosecutor's office against two wonderful men who were the lawyers for Richard LaPointe. They were just trying to do the best they could, but even as unschooled as we were in the legal matters, we could tell that they hadn't got caught up with the whole disability world, at least, in manners that they were addressing things and talking about things. And we did know that Bob was trying to educate them as quickly as he could from his perspective of being involved in disability for his whole lifetime. And so we began to get a sense that this was not going to go well for Richard. We understood it was a felony murder case. We kind of caught up on all the details. But it became very, having never met him and having just watched his stature and just his demeanor as he came in and out, that's about all we saw him do until he was on the stand. And then, that's another thing. But we just watched all of this, and we watched all the horrible things that were being said were done to this poor woman, and they had to be done by Richard. And we just couldn't connect those dots. That was not with what we knew about disability in general. Most of our work up to that particular point in time had been with men and women with what is now known as intellectual disabilities, mental retardation. And we didn't know anything about Dandy Walker syndrome, really. That was a new term to us, but we learned quickly. And as we began to find out about it and its particular, symptoms, if you will, of clumsiness and all the various things that people couldn't do because of Dandy Walker and the hydrocephaly that it caused, we said, this could not have happened this way. Up until, I don't think when we were originally and initially there that Tom Condon had written his article yet for the Hartford Current, which of course brought a lot of things together. We had heard about confessions, we had heard about all this and that, but we hadn't seen much detail on all that ourselves. We were just listening to what was going on day by day. And the most disturbing things to us were the way by which the prosecutors, particularly the lead prosecutor, was referring to the fact that Richard was not mentally retarded. He had just above it. I don't know what his exact, but that is in the 70s, I think. And therefore, he wasn't a person with disability. So they were defining, which is an old deal. He has to define all disability in terms of mental retardation.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't being answered very well by the prosecutors. By the defense people, because it just wasn't being challenged enough.
Mm-hmm.
I knew there were some folks that Bob had found and that we had known came into the picture eventually to sort of try to give a sense of the disabling condition of Dandy Walker syndrome, etc. But the disability issue revolved only around mental retardation, and therefore he knew what he was doing, and he was capable of doing what he was doing. And that seemed to be the two. And everybody seemed it was dancing around those particular things, and they seemed to stick. There were clearly some of the jury that was, I don't know what they were doing, but they weren't listening very well, particularly when the defense people were up there doing what they had to do. The judge, to my way of looking at it, was also done, and he was pretty interested in, just getting this thing to a conclusion that it seemed to us it was foregone, and not in Richard's favor. And so when we began to... During the course of these weeks that we were doing this, we would go out to have lunch or maybe right after court with Bob and a few folks and begin to sort of debrief on this. And of course there were the retired detective Andy and Florence, and those people that bring their perspectives into the picture. But it's very difficult to sit there, and so I found myself doing timelines, trying to figure out how is it that this man could, with his particular clumsiness and all, could get from his house, which is not too far away, to his grand mother-in-law's house, do all these awful things, and get himself back without a trace of any sweating or blood or anything of that sort. You know, it's all the stuff that has been talked about over and over again. And I just tried to do, you know, that's what I would present to Bob. I said, I just couldn't, it just didn't compute to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I gather that that's of the essence of what is being done, like, now.
Exactly.
In terms of the fire, when the fire started, didn't, and how to compress the time to see whether it was doable, if you will. And the thing that was, you know, we went through the court process and he was sentenced. Not sentenced. He was deemed guilty.
Mm-hmm.
Then the sentencing phase interviews came. And to our horror, because we had never even heard about this, what was admitted was Karen's tape, the tape of Karen being interrogated by the police officers and essentially being threatened in whatever way possible with losing her child and everything else
mm-hmm.
if she didn't agree with the fact that he was guilty in some way or corroborate some of the stuff that had been put in the confessions.
Mm-hmm.
And we listened to that, and we said, oh, how could anyone, as we did about 2 months ago in Vernon again, when we heard it with Karen sitting there,
yeah.
And the same feeling came over me, so how can anyone listen to this and not have a question, at least, in their mind, you know, if that, so.
But then it was sort of too late.
Well, it was
a question, you know.
Yeah, it was, and I don't know if that was the issue, the other issue that was very, 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 powerful in my memory is the testimony at the sentencing of the priest that was there. I don't know which priest it was, but the prosecutor was trying to get him actually to break his vow of secrecy from a confessional, and basically she asked him, you know, through various ways. You know, the final question that she had after sort of telling him that he really needed to do this, and then she asked him, did he feel that Richard was guilty? And he quickly answered no. And she quickly got him off the stand. And I don't know if that was the key or whatever, what was the key, but he wasn't sentenced to death, which was the alternative to the life sentence he did get. But the most pressing emotions to me throughout that was injustice. We had never been in the courts of law and stuff, but we could just see the injustice. And then one of the things that began to affect us too is that we would be there for most of the day, and then we would read the Hartford Courant the next day. You know, and it didn't match what was being written. Hartford Courant did not match what we had seen, or it was like half an hour. And then we began to notice that the Hartford Courant reporter really came in at the end of the day and was interviewing the prosecutors, basically,
mm-hmm.
and leaving. And I'm saying, geez, you know, there we go. It doesn't look like it's, you know, we've kind of naive in our thoughts of folks presenting what was actually done and said there, and a lot of things became clear in our minds about the imperfection of the justice system and the imperfection of the journalistic world and all of that. And I said, whoa,
all those scores.
And so we said, wow, poor Richard, woohoo. And so we began. And then when it all came down, the way it came down, we said, oh, what do you do in this instance? And then, of course, all the appeals and such. Well, as time was going along, as Bob called the first call, and the various people began to come into the picture and be at court, it became clear that somehow Bob had written, I don't know if you saw it, you probably must have, a volume many, many, many years ago called Circle of Friends.
Mm-hmm.
And from that book of Circle of Friends came the notion up in Canada, and then we began to do some things ourselves called Circles of Support. And And then, so with that notion in mind, Bob put together the Friends of Richard Point, the circle of friends, Richard Point, basically.
Oh, yeah, that's a connection I hadn't really realized before. That's
It comes. I don't know if I have this book here for you.
But not quickly. But anyhow, yeah, he was a huge mentor for us with in regard to the connection between Circle of Friends, Circle of Support, and the Friends of Richard LaPointe.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the notion is just being around, being together in support of somebody. Now, we had never done anything in relation to someone that was in jail and then ultimately in prison now. But that was what had happened, and we got together, began to get together to sort of plot strategies, how to support Richard, how to support the lawyers, how to support Bob, you know, basically in this whole notion of the fact that this man was innocent, but he was convicted. How did that ever happen?
Mm-hmm.
What do we do about this? And so thus began the meeting. Some of them were as informal as the ones right during the court. Then all of a sudden we began to meet at the Burger King for with formal meetings in terms of planned every so once, twice, three times a month, whatever. And then the Tom Condon article. I'm not sure of the timetable here. You must have it in terms of the date of the Tom Condon article versus, you know, in relation to when Richard was sentenced and went to jail. I don't know.
I think the big Tom Condon article, the one in Northeast Magazine, was after the whole trial and sentencing was complete.
Everything was done.
If I recall correctly.
Okay, probably trial. That makes sense in terms of the getting the full picture. But once that came out, then a number of more people joined the circle. John and his wife and such, saw that article, outraged, and called the number, the circle increased, and has ebbed and flowed throughout all these years now. The initial efforts, Pat and I began. Were deeply involved at the beginning, deeply involved in the initial stages of the circle, and then the circle became very, very legal, and it seemed to have a lot of people involved in it that really spoke to, which is very like all the circles of support that Pat and I are involved with people with disabilities. And when certain elements within the life of the person become important, the circle includes people that can be supportive there.
Mm-hmm.
And those people may not necessarily stay for other aspects of the circle. So people come and people go depending upon what's going on. And that happened to Pat and I. We never lost touch with Bob and never lost touch with the circle, but we didn't go regularly.
Mm-hmm.
To the circle, and we would come back. We'd be invited back for key things. One of the key things was when Mike Wallace came with 60 Minutes to look into things from his perspective after the Tom Condon article and all that. And then the various writers and folks who have been involved in things have come into the picture, trying to do what we all want to do, and that is free Richard.
Mm-hmm.
But it all for us, as we have said in this probably this little article that I gave you might give you a sense of it. We go on long walks with people,
mm-hmm.
And we've been on walks that many have called impossible walks. And this is another long walk. It's particularly difficult from Richard's perspective. And as you know, now we're talking about 2008, 2007 and such when we were meeting here, there are fits and starts of hope that he might be getting out because of the efforts of the Centurion Ministries folks and such. And that's where Pat and I feel that our gifts and our contribution can get back into the picture in a more intense way by developing that circle that relates to now what happens when he's out. how can we help Richard and those who would be supporting Richard, like Irv and Rosemary, for the first few months? How can we make all this a positive experience? Because it's not going to be easy. We're very aware of this. And so that's when where we feel our particular gifts and circle of friends and people that we know might come into the picture for Richard. Meanwhile, we meet every second Tuesday of the month at the prison with Richard for an hour or so. And Pat is in communication with him by letter often. That's her tremendous gift. And she's the provider of the various puzzles that Richard, you know, and much of our conversation every month is around which puzzles he's running out of and which puzzles he would like more of and a new puzzle that he's discovered, all of this. And it's good. It's very, very good because then we're the recipient of many of his jokes and his attitude, just trying to keep his spirits up. And that seems to be the essence of our walk with him personally right now.
Mm-hmm.
But it just, and our sense of outrage of injustice continues. There is hope. We couldn't be doing these walks without hope.
Mm-hmm.
But there is hope because of modern technologies and such. We know that DNA is out of the picture for lots of reasons, but that's the reality. Richard continues to be Richard, as we have been told about him by others and as we have experienced him ourselves. And he just is, he deals with what he has to deal with on a day-to-day basis. He's got his job again, which he's really happy in the kitchen, which he's really happy about. That happened maybe about a month or two ago, maybe within the last few weeks, actually. It's not too long, but he's very happy with that. He likes to be doing something. He just has, I can just see him going, you know, once he leaves the prison, gets back into some community aspect, it's going to be essentially the same Richard that left Manchester. How long ago now? 20 something years ago.
Yeah.
Now, it was 1989. Will be 20 years in next year. That's the gift of many of the people with disabilities, particularly those that have some form of cognitive disabilities, that we know. They just, if they have a positive attitude to begin with, everybody doesn't, but if they have a positive attitude to begin with, as Richard does, and he's a very, as Bob probably articulates better than any of us, he's a very concrete person. You know, what happens this moment, and the next moment, tomorrow, what happened yesterday, is very, very important to him, and he needs to get that clear. And once he does, he has rare moments of being really down. We haven't really experienced those personally ourselves. We hear about them from Irv and Bob and Rosemary and others who are in more contact with him by phone and by other ways. But our journey has been painful and rich. And being in touch with Bob, I mean, Bob is just an incredible friend and advocate to Richard and to all of us and all people. And he keeps all of us, just yesterday or the day before, we're trying to figure out what this new hearing is going to be all about, or whatever it is, going on not too long from now, 20 minutes that Paul has to address the judge, which I have gathered through listening to things and reading things is to overturn the decision of the last appeal, or at least to get another shot, I think. I'm sure the details of it, but it's a hope that we can go to another stage here and not be totally done with things. And Richard, is understanding a good deal of this and being troubled by other parts of it. And we hear a little bit this, so that when we go, when we visit with him, you know, we can sort of be a positive part of reinforcing. Because Richard's way of doing things is to double check everything with everybody who comes. and I'm sure that's the way he's survived. We have learned over almost every single visit that we have with him, his Richard's one desire, amid all desires outside of being free, is to see his son Sean again, constantly. Every time, at least once. But so we don't know. We'll see how we can make that happen or not. But that's.